This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 297 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, another week went by. That went quick.
It was a fast week. We've got another nice lineup of stories for this episode.
There's been a lot of balance in the news the last couple of weeks, it seems. There's a little bit of everything. A lot of times it's hard when we look for stories. We've got a Swiss drone crash. We've got a couple of stories about AI, nano drones, which I found really interesting, and drone swarms with the nano drones. A multi-drone system by Rio Police to secure soccer tournaments. Data management and Part 77 airport inspections, as well as a video of the week. So we got a full show, Max. We better get started. Our first story comes from TheVerge.com. Swiss drone crashes near children, forcing suspension of delivery program. This was back in May, but a 22-pound Swiss post office drone crashed 50 yards away from a group of children. This isn't good.
That's always cause for concern. As a result, the delivery program in Switzerland has been indefinitely suspended. Of course, this is the program that Swiss Post does in conjunction with Matternet. Swiss Post has asked Matternet to make a few safety changes, which when you take a look at, you get an idea of what might have happened with this drone.
Yeah, each drone to be connected to its parachute by two ropes instead of one. It did have a parachute, however, the parachute seemed to fail or feather. So the drone came crashing down a lot quicker than it would have. In all fairness, Matternet and Swiss Post, they thought ahead, but evidently in practicality, it's better to have redundancy and have an extra parachute.
And Swiss Post is also asking Matternet to reinforce the parachute ropes, reinforce them with metal braiding. So that would pretty much ensure that there wouldn't be any failure of the ropes or the cords that the parachute is attached to. And also they are looking for a louder emergency landing whistle. And we've seen this before. Parachute systems often employ this whistle so that if it's coming down under a parachute, if there's anyone on the ground, they can hear the whistle and have enough time to get out of the way of this parachuting drone.
They did put things in place that provided some safety, but, you know, you can never have too much. Although, you know, extra wiring and extra parachutes, that's weight. But it's important that they do this, especially flying over people. We want these things to be successful. Other than that, Matternet and Swiss Post have been fairly successful with their deliveries.
I think so. They had an incident back in January where there was some kind of an issue with the GPS system on the drone. And it had to make an emergency landing. And in that case, the parachute successfully deployed, and the landing didn't cause any problems, I guess. But that's, I think, a different kind of an issue than what we've seen this past May with this parachute system failure. Everything's new, and almost everything is going to work almost all of the time. And as we all get more experience with these things, that changes will be made to continue to improve the safety aspects. That's kind of to be expected, I think.
So let's move on to what I used to hate about radio-controlled airplanes, balancing props. It's something you need to learn to do. And let's face it, quadcopters have four times more props than my good old Cox 049 trainer. So balancing props is really important. And this is from Drone Below. They're starting to use AI to balance propellers.
Boy, this is showing up everywhere. AI is anyway. This is a study by some Italian researchers, and they've been looking at measuring the noise emitted by the drone. So they've been attaching, I guess, little pieces of paper to the propellers to cause them to go out of balance to different degrees, and recording the noise, the sound that they make, and using that data to teach an artificial intelligence model to detect when there are propellers that are out of balance. So I guess, David, the way this would work is you'd have some kind of maybe it could even be an app, but associated with something that can record sound or measure sound, read sound, feed it to the AI model, and before flight could tell you that, no, all your propellers are in perfect balance or that they're not. Kind of makes a lot of sense.
Yes, especially for someone who's a hobbyist or a prosumer, you know, it'd be kind of fun, kind of cool that you just sort of crank it up and stick your phone near it and it will tell you it's balanced. I mean, everything else is an app. This should probably be an app also, but it is something that when I read it, I went, oh yeah, balancing props. That's, you know, it's, you know, and knowing which props are which, you know, when you have a quadcopter, a lot of times you have counter-rotating props. There's a helicopter, a medevac helicopter in the area that I and my other friend are noticeably know it by its sound, because I'm 99% sure one of the rotor blades is out of balance because it makes a whoop, whoop, whoop that other helicopters like it don't. It's definitely important, and it improves the efficiency and the safety of the aircraft.
And this model is apparently proving to be fairly accurate. According to the article, it says that this AI model showed a value for accuracy of 0.9763. So that's, you know, almost 98% accurate.
So let's talk a little bit more about AI. This is also from DroneBelow.com. Drones chasing drones using deep learning and AI. How does one drone detect another drone and follow it? I don't know if it's sense and avoid or follow my leader. This is from a Canadian outfit that's proposing a pursuit UAV for drones that are flying in airspace that shouldn't be.
So there's two approaches that they're talking about in this Canadian study. One is to use deep reinforcement learning to predict the actions to apply to the follower drone to keep track of the target drone. And the other is use a deep object detector and a search area proposal to predict the position of the target UAV for tracking purposes. Okay, I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Well, I believe deep reinforcement is having it go through the same routine over and over and over again, so it will automatically add that to its memory, so that if the drone in front of it turns left, after it's seen the drone in front of it turn left, say 100 times, it will know what action to take. It won't need to guess. Deep reinforcement, I think, is a little bit like muscle memory.
Oh.
And if I'm wrong, somebody reach out to me, but it senses what's ahead of it and it knows, it has a feeling what it does, and it doesn't need to really think about it. It just needs to react. Now, deep object detector means that, I think that means that as it goes and looks out through a wide spectrum, it runs probabilities, and in that spectrum, it says, okay, it's going to turn right or it's going to turn left. if that makes sense.
Yeah, this is outside of my field. But apparently, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the study if you really want to get into this and understand what all this stuff is about or want to learn more. But according to the article, it says that the efficiency of these algorithms being proposed has been demonstrated in outdoor tracking scenarios where they've been using real UAVs. So there's some field work that's been done to validate this. It's more than just a theoretical exercise, it would seem.
But we're talking about this for drone swarms, so let's talk about nano drones. Someone's on their opinion of drones of the size that I'm capable of flying. And this is from thehandsindia.com. DragonEye drone project was announced in 2017. A real dragonfly wears a tiny backpack filled with electronic sensors and a solar cell. We talked about this a little bit before, that the electrical impulses of the radio controlled the dragonfly, so they could model how a nano drone dragonfly would fly.
Another example of some nano drones is work that AeroVironment has been doing. They've been working on a nano hummingbird for quite some time, since 2011. Kind of the most eye-opening thing in this article for me, David, was that they talk about what they expect the size of the nano drone market to be by 2023.
Which is 13.4 billion with a B. And biodegradable nano drones in the field of medicine are quickly catching momentum as well. This was kind of interesting in the article where they were talking about Fantastic Voyage coming to life. If you know the movie Fantastic Voyage, the president needs to have surgery and they shrink a spaceship down and inject it into the president so that they can do the surgery to save the president. Well, in this case, they want nano drones to be able to do that, to be able to eject them in and be able to either have them figure it out on their own or be able to pilot them to be able to do surgery, et cetera, as a less evasive way of doing it.
I bet we're a ways away from that.
Agreed, but it's an indication that people are thinking ahead. I could have used a nano drone a couple of weeks ago. It's a little bit, you know, science fiction is becoming science fact. And when we started this show, Max, do you think we would be talking about drones flying in blood systems?
Definitely not. It's kind of typical of when you have a real game-changing new technology is at the beginning, you can perhaps envision some applications that are kind of extrapolating things as they were. But when you introduce something new like this, you know, the door's wide open for developing things that you can't even imagine at the beginning. And we're seeing that. So I guess this is an example of that.
And if one drone isn't enough, try a drone swarm. This is from BBC.com. Drones are being used for precision agriculture. Well, of course we know that. But there are problems with one drone and a big farm. Now, that seems to be a common theme, though originally we talked about the fact that even one drone makes a farmer's life a lot easier with viticulture or agriculture. But BBC goes on to say what?
Well, the battery life, of course, is short. So if you've got a really large farm, it's going to take you a long time to survey that farm with just one drone. And you're going to have to change batteries, you know, quite often, maybe over and over and over and over, many, many times. So the idea here is that, well, why not employ a swarm of drones to make the whole process quicker, more efficient? And there's a couple of organizations that have been working on this.
One is a Norwegian defense research establishment and Rangent Corporation in the U.S., and they're both working on drone flocking, which is decentralized communication, drones self-organized with little human supervision. You know, I kind of find it interesting, Max, that all these years agriculture didn't want swarms of anything, like locusts. But now they're embracing swarms of drones to fly over their property.
Now, this company, Rajant, has a radio technology. They call it kinetic mesh, and that's what's being used here, as well as a what they call a, quote, foreign function interface, which is a distributed computing software system. What you don't have is one person operating these drones individually, but they're working together in this mesh system to perform the crop surveys.
Max, and this kind of technology isn't new. There was something that C-130s used for years, which was SKI, which was station keeping antenna, which you set up and it locked onto, if you were flying a formation of C-130s, you would set up your C-130 to ping the other C-130 using the SKI antenna. And that's how you would keep formation, would be the, they would go back and forth to each other to keep communicating so that they would keep together in formation, especially in inclement weather. With a mesh design or a grid design, it's not only side by side, but it's front and back and vertical. So I can understand the mesh covering a lot of area and one pilot operating all of them. Now, the foreign function interface would be, should one of those drones that's flying in formation with the other drones run into something like a silo, it needs to be able to adapt and notify the other ones as it goes around the silo. So I have a feeling that's what foreign function interface is. Hmm. It detects something that's blocking its path or blocking the swarm's path and notifies the swarm to go around it or that way. So that was my interpretation of the foreign function interface.
Now, of course, there's another issue here, which is that a farmer might be able to afford a single drone and the software and the systems required to do a crop survey. But if you're talking about a swarm of drones, then that may be too expensive for a smaller farmer to afford. So there are some ideas, maybe that would drive towards cooperatives forming that could take advantage of drone swarms for precision agriculture, or maybe what we would see is the rise of certified drone service providers, somebody that would come in with a swarm of drones and do the survey in a short period of time and then provide that data to the farmer, in which case the farmer wouldn't have to own his own or her own swarm of drones.
But they're coming, the swarms of drones. The United States this week, I didn't put in this story in, but got approved for C-130 recovered swarms of drones that we've talked about in the past. That had come up over the last week. So drone swarms are coming. Skynet is, you know, we've talked about drone swarms and artificial intelligence. Skynet's well on its way. And let's talk about more multi-drone systems. In this case, a practical application used by Rio military police to secure soccer tournaments.
Or football, if you're...
Or football. Yeah. And if anybody knows anything about football tournaments in Latin and South America, they can be kind of blood sports. In fact, there is something called the Soccer War, which occurred in the Caribbean, where it's the last war, just so people know that I'm a history geek, it was the last war the piston engine fighters like F-4U Corsairs of Honduras versus P-51s of the Dominican Republic fought against each other. Now, most of those aircraft that survived are now on our warbird circuit. But so soccer protection and, you know, they build moats around the field to keep the people away. And we thought football was a tough sport, but soccer's bad, or football.
Along with the military police of Rio de Janeiro, the company Atlas Dynamics partnered with them And they use these Atlas Pro drones to provide security around the perimeter of the stadium for the final series of this Copa America soccer tournament or football tournament. But this was a different kind of a scenario. They used single and multi UAS missions, but it really wasn't a swarm in the sense that we were talking about in the previous item. I think that this mesh multi-drone UAS technology that Atlas provides allows a single operator to manage a number of drones. But I think that's being done centralized. It's not a distributed system. But Atlas is a company. There's actually several Atlas drone companies out there, which makes it sort of confusing. This one specializes in the design and manufacture of autonomous UAS for security organizations, first responders, organizations like that. And this mesh multi-node communications capability allows a single operator to command and control a network of drones from one single ground control station.
So you've got all of these drones flying around, accumulating data. Then what do you do? Again, one of the challenges with drones is all of the data these accumulate. This story comes from unmannedaerial.com. A report says data management, a challenge for public safety UAS programs. Drone responders, and we'll have a link to theirs in the show notes, has released a new report, 2019 Mid-Year Public Safety UAS Report. Three out of four public safety agencies say they're already either operating drones or working on implementing a drone program. Boy, Max, we're approaching 300 episodes, and boy, have we come a long way.
That's a much higher number than I would have expected. Also, we see from drone responders that more than 80% of the public safety UAS operators, they've either obtained or are pursuing Part 107 certification. I think that's kind of where I would expect it, pretty high at 80%. And that 82% of the agencies, the public safety agencies with a UAS program, well, they're operating multi-rotor systems. Only 11% are using fixed-wing or delta-wing drones. I think that's also not surprising, wouldn't you think?
I would think given public safety, you don't need the advantage of a fixed-wing drone unless you're doing a long search and rescue for someone like they've used out in Texas. You're responding usually to an immediate thing, so being able to throw up a quadcopter is a lot easier than throwing up a fixed wing, especially if you want to monitor one point. Interesting also was over 35% of the public safety UAS programs are using FAA's LANS system for airspace requests. So clearly this industry for public safety is moving along carefully with and following the FAA procedures. They're setting up a standards for all of these people to operate safely.
Although drone responders does note a couple of challenges that public safety agencies are facing here. One is a lack of standardized training and procedures for public safety remote pilots. Also, there's a need, they say, to continue to adopt professional aviation decision-making and risk management standards, another standards issue. They also say that there needs to be an improved understanding of operations within the national airspace system, as well as greater proficiency at, and this goes back to, you know, where you were starting, David, greater proficiency at managing UAS data in producing actionable intelligence for incident commanders. Managing the data, I can understand why that might come at the tail end of people's thinking, right? You probably are more concerned about obtaining the hardware and software, getting the operators trained, you know, developing the missions. But how you manage all that data appropriately is something that sooner or later you have to get a good handle on.
Agreed. And You know, it's kind of funny, but having been in a data management role, you're not aware of how much you're getting until you start getting it. And the initial setup and for these programs, like you said, is a challenge. But then you've got the challenge of, okay, what am I getting? How am I getting it? And what am I going to use it for? You're right. I think that's one of those things that comes as a secondary thought, not necessarily a primary. And we've seen the data issue come across in multiple areas. You know, the only people who are hungry for data happen to be the FAA. They want all the data they can get, but they have a built-in system to manage it. So we'll have to keep seeing, but good for public safety for following the procedures. And again, 3 out of 4 public safety org groups, that's a big number. And it supports our initial premise of drones for good. People are finding practical applications for safety, et cetera. So let's talk about more practical applications, like when you get permission to fly over an airport.
Right. Usually we're talking about people flying in the airport airspace inappropriately, but there are applications where you want to have a drone in the airport airspace. And this is something that AeroTech is doing. They've completed a couple of proof of concept aerial surveys, both in Washington State. One was at Sunnyside Municipal Airport, the other at Prosser Airport. And they used some drones to do some runway inspections using photogrammetry. They've been studying this in collaboration with the Washington State Department of Transportation Aviation Division. And this is a requirement of the FAA that there be some method for ensuring that the runways are clear. And this is a great application for a drone as opposed to sending some trucks out to go scout out the runways.
Or using a plane or a helicopter.
Hmm.
But the UAS images were used to create virtual models of the airports. These were analyzed to identify obstacles. So the other part about this is once you do that, you have a computer model that you can use as a way to verify. You have a before and you can get an after. These were all meeting the requirements of FAA, FAR 14, CFR Part 77. And me saying that makes me feel like I'm on an episode of Dragnet. But I like the fact that you have a before and after. You can you build a model and you have that data forever. A year or so from now, you can go back and look at that data, fly a drone again and compare them to see what the changes are and making it easier for airports to maintain their facilities. Because you don't really want a pothole in the middle of a runway.
AeroTech, and that's AeroTech, they're a Seattle-based company, and they provide aerospace testing, engineering, and certification services. They're not a drone startup. The director of the Washington State DOT says the successful completion of these aerial photogrammetry surveys means we have found a significant cost-saving opportunity for the taxpayers of Washington State. Utilizing UAS to map airports and provide precision data in regards to obstructions around airports is just one of the many uses we envision. He says this is a great step in leveraging the technology to perform tasks that traditionally took a lot of time and effort.
Let's move on there, Max. We've got a video of the week. My advice to anybody watching this video is, personally, I had just eaten lunch, and I don't recommend that. But
did you get a little queasy?
I got a little queasy. If anybody's seen like Red Bull, where people are flying with wingsuits down a mountain, well, in this case, it's a first-person view of a drone barreling down and around mountain feels just like a flying dream. It's a really cool video, but I realized today that I'm not geared for a wingsuit. Maybe jumping out of a perfectly good airplane, but not a wingsuit, especially not a wingsuit in the middle of mountains and crevices, etc.
I don't know where this was filmed, but it's really dramatic mountain peaks and valleys and waterfalls and gullies and ravines and everything in between. It's a long trip. It was a 7-kilometer trip. I think almost certainly not within visual line of sight the whole way, but it is a rather dramatic video. I liked it a lot, David.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun video to watch if you're not like me and have a weak stomach these days. And you know what, Max? We've got a really important episode because not only did we have a video a week, but we've got feedback from our friend Jonathan Ruprecht and Ruprecht Law. And the subject of the email was FAA drone sighting data is unreliable. Here's what the FAA said. We sort of knew this, but given the amount of times that we've had to report that there's a drone strike and then later on things like feathers have been found. But this is a more concrete answer that people are reporting a lot of UFOs and they're not drones.
The problem with drone sightings coming from pilots primarily, is that you can't verify most of the reports. And why can't you verify them? Well, he says that small UAS are typically not detected by radar, so you don't have any radar data to support the sighting. The UAS pilot is usually not identified. Usually there's no physical evidence that is ever recovered. And also identifying a small UAS from a moving airplane is pretty difficult because the UAS is, the drone is small. The distance between the aircraft and the drone can be great. The relative speeds can be pretty high, the difference between them. And there are other various factors, he says, competing for the pilot's attention. So I don't think the conclusion is necessarily that all of these drone sightings or most of these drone sightings are in fact not drones. To me, the conclusion is you can't demonstrate that they are all drones. So it's a little different flavor on that. But Jonathan provided a link to an article. So if you'd like to explore this in more detail, head on over to the show notes and click on over to the Ruprecht Law website where this article is.
When you're trying to land an airplane, I was thinking about this. You've got so much going on, and a lot of these sightings are on final approach into airports and stuff. And pilots are paying attention to flying the airplane, you know, and out of their corner of their eye, they see a drone. You know, eventually we're going to have mishaps, but like we started the show with, but a lot of them aren't, you know, and a lot of them just sort of disappear and are sensational headlines. And we've covered a lot of those. But thank you, Jonathan, for sending us that link.
You know, just last weekend, David, when I was flying in Maine in a Stearman biplane,
rub it in some more.
At one point, looking out the side of the cockpit there, I saw a drone. It was below us. It was white. It was traveling at a different heading than where we were traveling. So there was an angle there. And I thought, wow, I'm seeing a drone below us. But I started looking at it, and I thought, I think it's a drone. Maybe it's a seagull because it's white. It's kind of that size. I think it's a drone. And this is after, you know, I don't know, 20 seconds of me staring at it, trying to decide if this is a drone or not. And you know, in the end, I'm pretty sure it was a drone, but I'm not positive. It's really hard to positively identify a drone from an airplane that high, that far, at that speed. I think, you know, Jonathan is correct in that.
So now that Max has rubbed it in that he's gone flying in a Stearman and I haven't, I think maybe we should wrap this show up. What do you think, Max?
All right. Thanks, all of you, for listening to episode 297 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us at the UAVDigest.com. You'll find show notes there for this episode and every episode. But if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, just visit the UAVDigest.com/297.
And of course, you can join us on our Slack listener team. You can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theUAVDigest.com. We'll be happy to send you a link and you can join the conversation. We also would like you to send us feedback. Let us know how we're doing, if there's something you want us to talk about. You know, we're always wanting to hear from you guys, our listeners. And you can engage us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook, UAV Digest. And of course, if you do listen to us, we would greatly appreciate you send us a review, either on whatever podcast catcher platform you use, Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and let us know how we're doing. So with that, I'm going to say, this is David, hot in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.